From National Public Radio, the Iran-Contra Affair, a special report on the Congressional Select Committee hearings. Cokie Roberts. Today was the day the congressional committees had been waiting for, the first day of public testimony from Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, the man who ran the two operations under investigation, the sale of arms to Iran and the supplying of the Nicaraguan rebels. North told the committees he had never discussed the diversion of profits from the arms sales with President Reagan, but that he never acted without authorization from superiors. North also gave the committees the first sworn testimony that President Reagan had approved in writing a straight arms for hostages deal in 1985. First News.
This is Lori Waffen-Schmidt. Fired National Security Council aide Oliver North gave his first public testimony today in the Congressional Iran-Contra investigation. The Marine Lieutenant Colonel said he never personally discussed with President Reagan the diversion of Iran arms sale profits to the Nicaraguan rebels, but he said he assumed the president knew about it. North admitted that he and the late William Casey, then CIA director, falsified Casey's planned congressional testimony.
Director Casey and I fixed that testimony and removed the offensive portions. And we fixed it by omission. We left out. It wasn't made accurate. It wasn't made fulsome. It was fixed by omission.
North also said he and Casey and other administration officials worked up a phony chronology about the arms sales and subsequent funds diversion. North said he believes he did nothing illegal while serving on the NSC staff. While North was on Capitol Hill telling what he knows about President Reagan's role in the Iran-Contra affair, the president was carrying on the people's business, according to White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater. Fitzwater said the president didn't watch the hearings today because he was too busy. Fitzwater said Mr. Reagan will get a summary of the testimony and probably will watch the evening news. A videotape of kidnapped American journalist Charles Glass was released today, in which he says he worked for the CIA. The group which released the tape, the Organization for the Free People's Defense, has previously claimed it abducted Glass. From Beirut, Jim Muir reports on what Glass said.
Although both the visual and audio quality of the videotape were extremely poor, Mr. Glass looked depressed and drawn as he read out the prepared statement. He seemed to have trouble enunciating some of the words, and his voice broke at several points. Reading haltingly from the text, Mr. Glass said that he'd come to Lebanon on a secret mission from the CIA office in London, and that he'd held numerous meetings and contacts with many parties and leaders in the country, using the press as a cover for what he called my main job with the CIA, collecting information for its benefit.
Jim Muir prepared that report for the BBC. Here in the U.S., the Reagan administration quickly responded to the release of the videotape. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
The White House, the State Department, and the Central Intelligence Agency all denied that Charles Glass worked for the CIA. The State Department went further, denying that he had ever worked for the U.S. government. Bill Baker, Director of Public Affairs at the CIA, said that internal regulations prohibit the agency from entering into a relationship with any journalist accredited by U.S. media. Exceptions to the policy can be made, but Baker said, "I can explicitly state that Charles Glass is not an exception." Baker added that journalists are free to volunteer information to the CIA, but that Glass had not done even that. The U.S. government said Glass's statement had obviously been made under duress and should not be regarded as valid. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
The chairman of the House Armed Services Committee says there is a discrepancy between the American and the Kuwaiti versions of the U.S. plan to protect Kuwaiti tankers in the Persian Gulf. Congressman Les Aspin has just returned from Kuwait, where he headed a congressional fact-finding tour. Aspin says the Kuwaitis believe the U.S. has agreed to protect virtually all of that country's oil tankers passing through the Gulf. The White House says only 11 Kuwaiti tankers will be placed under American protection. If the Soviet Union will pull its ships out of the Persian Gulf if the United States, Britain, and France do the same. The Soviet Foreign Ministry spokesman made that statement today, clarifying an earlier Kremlin call for all foreign ships to leave the volatile Gulf region. At that time, the Soviets did not say their own ships would withdraw. Six Chernobyl nuclear plant workers went on trial today in the Soviet Ukraine. The Soviet news agency TASS says the men are charged with violating safety regulations in connection with the world's worst nuclear plant accident. The trial is being held in the deserted town of Chernobyl, less than 20 miles from the plant, and technicians checked everyone entering the courtroom for traces of radiation. The accident killed 31 people. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
Hello, I'm Cokie Roberts. This is a special NPR report on the Iran-Contra investigation. Today, Marine Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, the man at the center of the operations to sell arms to Iran and divert profits to the Nicaraguan rebels, the man all other witnesses have credited with masterminding the plans, the man who has kept his silence adamantly until today. Today, Oliver North testified. But even today, after weeks of negotiation with the congressional committees over the terms of his testimony, North tried to obtain some special conditions. His lawyer, Brendan Sullivan, sent a letter to the congressional committees last night requesting that the rule governing witnesses testifying under immunity be waived, that Oliver North be allowed to make an opening statement. Senate Chairman Daniel Inouye replied that the rules require that any opening statement be filed with the committees 48 hours in advance. Inouye continued.
We have been here sitting for several weeks, and we will continue to do so to receive testimony and consider one thing above others, the rule of law. Here once again, the witness is asking us to bend the law and to suggest that he may be above the law. We will abide with his wishes. However, we will insist upon following the rule of law. And if the colonel wishes to make the opening statement, he may do so Thursday morning, which is 48 hours from this date.
The lawmakers think Oliver North and his attorney have tried to play with the congressional process by refusing to testify in private and then setting the terms of the former National Security Aide's public testimony. But North's lawyer, Brendan Sullivan, charged that the committees were interfering with the constitutional process.
This is the most extraordinary proceeding, I think, Mr. Chairman, in our 200 years. As a defense lawyer, I have never been in a position where a client is forced to testify about all matters which are the subject of a pending indictment. We believe he has an absolute right not to testify under the Fifth Amendment. The committee has worked hand in glove with the independent counsel in order to facilitate two things. One, so you can get your factual account, and secondly, to defeat the benefits of the immunity statute.
The hostility between the men on the dais and the men behind the witness table was palpable as the questioning began over the repeated objections of North's lawyer. And House Chief Counsel John Neal started on an accusatory note, reminding Oliver North that the administration had first concealed the facts about the Iranian arms sales and then distorted them.
In certain communist countries, the government's activities are kept secret from the people. But that's not the way we do things in America, is it?
Counsel, I would like to go back to what I said just a few moments ago. I think it is very important for the American people to understand that this is a dangerous world, that we live at risk, and that this nation is at risk in a dangerous world, and that they ought not to be led to believe as a consequence of these hearings that this nation cannot or should not conduct covert operations. By their very nature, covert operations or special activities are a lie. There is great deceit, deception practiced in the conduct of covert operations. They are, at essence, a lie. We make every effort to deceive the enemy as to our intent, our conduct, and to deny the association of the United States with those activities.
That explanation of covert activities forms the heart of the North defense. It was a theme he returned to over and over in the course of the day. But before the Marine Lieutenant Colonel had a chance to make many speeches, John Neal's got to the heart of what the committees want to know. What did the president know about the diversion of the proceeds of Iranian arms sales to the Contras?
I never personally discussed the use of the residuals or profits from the sale of U.S. weapons to Iran for the purpose of supporting the Nicaraguan resistance with the president. I never raised it with him, and he never raised it with me during my entire tenure at the National Security Council staff. throughout the conduct of my entire tenure at the National Security Council, I assumed that the President was aware of what I was doing and had, through my superiors, approved it. I sought approval of my superiors for every one of my actions, and it is well documented. I assumed, when I had approval to proceed from either Judge Clark, Bud McFarlane, or Admiral Poindexter, that they had indeed solicited and obtained the approval of the President.
But North then admitted that he did not preclude... But North further testified that last November he asked Admiral Poindexter, his superior, directly, does the President know? Poindexter told North the President did not. That answer led to questioning about the now famous diversion memo, the document found by the Justice Department team investigating the Iran arms sales last November, where the use of profits from the transactions for the Contras is stated in writing. The memorandum was found in the files, and it bore no sign of presidential approval. President Reagan has repeatedly said that he neither saw the memo nor knew of the diversion. North revealed today that the document the committee has is a draft, but there were at least five such memoranda, and that he believed at least three of them went up through the chain of command to the president for approval, though he claimed he could not remember actually having seen one of these diversion memos checked or initialed by the president.
Well, that's the whole reason for shredding documents, isn't it, Colonel North? So that you can later say you don't remember whether you had them and you don't remember what's in them.
No, Mr. Niels, the reason for shredding documents and the reason the government of the United States gave me a shredder, I mean, I didn't buy it myself, was to destroy documents that were no longer relevant, that did not apply or that should not be divulged. And again, I want to go back to the whole intent of a covert operation. Part of a covert operation is to offer plausible deniability of the association of the government of the United States with the activity. Part of it is to deceive our adversaries. Part of it is to ensure that those people who are at great peril carrying out those activities are not further endangered. All of those are good and sufficient reasons to destroy documents.
Counsel Nields inquired about just what documents were shredded and why. Nields was particularly interested in the so-called shredding party last November that Robert McFarlane, North's former boss, and Fawn Hall, his secretary, have testified to. House counsel pressed on whether any of the documents shredded that day revealed presidential approval of the diversion. North said he was sure they did not because he thought all documents relating to the diversion had already been destroyed.
I assured Admiral Poindexter, incorrectly, it seems, that all of those documents no longer existed. And so that is early on November 21st, because I believe the decision to make an inquiry, to have the Attorney General, or Mr. Meese in his role as friend of the President, conduct a fact-finding excursion on what happened in September and November in 1985, I assured the Admiral, don't worry, it's all taken care of.
You've already shredded them.
That's right. So the answer to your question about November 21st is no, sir.
But North then admitted that he did not preclude the possibility that the shredding of documents on November 21st had something to do with the investigation which was about to take place. The committee counsel then moved on to questions about the chronology of events surrounding the Iranian arms sales prepared by high administration officials as the story became public. The altering of those chronologies to change the facts has been documented many times over by these committees. The changes were found in the White House computers in internal messages known as prof notes. Oliver North told the committees today that everyone involved was shocked to discover that the prof notes existed.
We all sincerely believed that when we sent a prof's message to another party and punched the button delete, that it was gone forever. Wow, were we wrong.
Nields pushed on the chronologies, asking North whose idea it was to include false statements in documents being prepared for the president and ultimately for the American people. North claimed he did not know, but added there were good reasons for falsifying the facts. He contended the truth could endanger the lives of the American hostages, and it could politically embarrass President Reagan. But the Marine Lieutenant Colonel charged he could not be held personally responsible for false statements. He was hardly the only one involved. As North put it, Admiral Poindexter was witting, so was CIA Director Casey, and a whole cabinet full of people who knew that the U.S. government had engineered the shipment of arms to Iran in November of 1985, even though the chronology being prepared asserted falsely that the U.S. thought it was an Israeli operation and that the Israelis were shipping oil drilling equipment. Then North told the committees something that some members have tried for weeks to learn, that President Reagan not only knew about that November 1985 shipment of missiles to Iran, but that he had approved it in writing. The CIA counsel, Stanley Sporkin, had earlier testified to the committees that he had prepared what's called a finding, an authorization for a covert action, in late November of 1985. It was a simple document with simple language. Arms were traded for hostages, it said. Sporkin said he assumed the president had signed the finding, but he had never seen a signed copy, and neither the Tower Commission nor the committees could locate a signed finding from 1985. Today, Colonel North testified that he had seen such a document.
It is my understanding that the finding was signed.
And what is the basis for your understanding?
I believe, although I do not recall specifically, but I believe I saw a signed copy of that finding.
Where?
Admiral Poindexter's office.
Did you have a copy of it in your office?
I did not. I had a draft copy.
When did you see the signed finding?
I think I may have seen a signed copy of it in early December.
North further testified that he thought Attorney General Edwin Meese was involved in crafting that finding, as attorneys general usually are. Meese has denied knowledge of the 1985 arms sales. The revelation of the finding made the false chronologies even more of a problem for Committee Counsel John Nields, who continued to assert that they committed the entire administration to telling a lie. At that, North shot back.
I'm not trying to pass the buck here. Okay, I did a lot of things, and I want to stand up and say that I'm proud of them. I don't want you to think, counsel, that I went about this all on my own. I realize there's a lot of folks around that think there's a loose cannon on the Gundeck estate at the NSC. That wasn't what I heard while I worked there. I've only heard it since I left. People used to walk up to me and tell me what a great job I was doing. And the fact is, there were many, many people, to include the former Assistant to the President for National Security Affairs, the current National Security Advisor, the Attorney General of the United States of America, the Director of Central Intelligence, all of whom knew that to be wrong.
After a somewhat tense morning, the afternoon session of the committee hearings settled into the now familiar pattern of having a lawyer for the committees take a witness through his story, although in this case, the committees had not heard the story directly from the witness before in private. John Nields asked about the sale of arms to Iran and then about the program to solicit funds for the Nicaraguan rebels.
Mr. McFarland has testified that he gave you instructions not to solicit money from foreign countries or private sources. Did he give you those instructions?
I never carried out a single act, not one, Mr. Nields, in which I did not have authority from my superiors. I haven't, in the 23 years that I have been in the uniformed services of the United States of America, ever violated an order. Not one.
But that wasn't the question. The question
was... That is the answer to your question.
No, the question was, did Mr. McFarland give you such instructions?
No. I never heard those instructions.
And I take it that it was your understanding from what you've just said that, quite to the contrary, you were authorized to seek money from foreign countries.
I was authorized to do everything that I did.
Well, again, that isn't the question.
I was authorized to have a meeting in this particular case in specific by Mr. McFarland for the purpose of talking to the man about a suggestion that had been made to him by others and to encourage that process along, and I did so. I had already provided to Mr. McFarland a card with the address of an account, an offshore account which would support the Nicaraguan resistance. And thank God somebody put money into that account and the Nicaraguan resistance didn't die, as perhaps others intended. Certainly the Sandinistas and Moscow and Cuba intended that, and they didn't die. They grew in strength and numbers and effectiveness as a consequence. And I think that is a good thing.
North later chastised the Congress for its unwillingness to support the Contras and insisted that the administration approved of his activities, activities he regularly reported on through what he called innumerable memoranda to his superiors. Suddenly, in mid-1985, the flow of paper through regular channels stopped. Nields asked why. North answered that publicity about the operation forced him to communicate more privately by computer notes. Neil suggested there might be another reason for making the messages more secret.
Are you saying that your decision to stop putting these documents in the system had nothing to do with the fact that they were pulled out of the system by Mr. McFarland for the purpose in response to a congressional request for documents?
No, I think we arrived at a point, and I don't recall whether it was his idea or my idea, in 1985 to stop putting these documents in the system. You're right. I'm not saying it was his idea. It might have been mine. But in any way, we decided not to.
And that arose out of the fact that Congress had asked to look at the documents.
Well, sure.
And the documents that were gathered for them all came out of the system.
Exactly.
And you didn't want to show Congress the documents in the system.
I didn't want to show Congress a single word on this whole thing.
North proudly testified about his role in helping channel funds to the Contras and in bringing the contributors of those funds to meet the president. John Nields asked about a memo North wrote to John Poindexter, his boss, in which North said President Reagan was meeting to thank the private donors and obviously knew the purpose of those meetings.
Was the president aware of your U.S. operation to raise funds for the Contras from private contributors?
Well, I think that that prof's note right there indicates that I believed he was. But I didn't ever walk in and, by the way, say to him, Mr. President, this is what I did. I know I've been accused of those kinds of things, but I didn't do that. And the fact is that I assumed, and I think that's a fairly clear indication, I'm sending my boss what I thought was going to be a very private note that would never see the light of day anywhere else. And I said to him what I felt. And I was asking him for guidance.
And he certainly didn't tell you to stop.
Why would he? We were conducting a covert operation to support the Nicaraguan resistance, to carry out the President of the United States stated, publicly articulated foreign policy. Why should he tell me to stop? We weren't breaking any laws. We were simply trying to keep an operation covert.
Thank you, Colonel North. I have no further questions this afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
John Nields thus ended the questioning for today. Oliver North reappears on the stand tomorrow. Joining me now in the studio is Daniel Schur, NPR's special correspondent. Dan, it was quite a dramatic day in that hearing room today, very testy in the morning, got smoother in the afternoon. We heard a lot from Oliver North about this question of covert operations. What strategy do you think he's operating under here?
Well, I think the strategy that he's worked out with his excellent counsel, Brendan Sullivan, is twofold. One is to try to get people to accept the ethic of the covert operation, that if a covert operation is justified in the national interest, then deception is also justified as part of it, that making up documents, telling Congress and the public wrong things is all part of a covert operation, and that is to be explained and understood and justified in its own way. The second strategy apparently is to diminish his own role. Everybody had looked to him as the mastermind of this whole operation. He is very generous now in passing off responsibility for most of the important actions to others. Anyone who thought that he was going to bare his chest to the spears and arrows is wrong. At every point, he says, Attorney General Meese knew about that, but McFarlane told me to do that. Other people sat around while we put together this false chronology, and he said, and nobody would ever believe I could call the Pentagon and ask for 100 missiles if it was I, a lieutenant colonel, alone.
So however, on the basis of the oak leaves on my collar.
Oak leaves on my collar. So that the strategy clearly is, you've got it all wrong, people. I am not a mysterious presence behind all of this. I was just one of the Indians and not the chief.
He not only told us about some of those higher-ups that were, or hires-up, who were involved in these things. He really did finger Attorney General Edwin Meese, who has said that he didn't know about some of these things that Oliver North said he did, particularly this 1985 finding, this so-called finding, an authorization that North says he saw a signed authorization by the president for arms shipments to Iran in 1985.
That may be the most important specific piece of news to come out of today's hearing, because that's the so-called mysterious lost finding that nobody could find anymore because it seems to have been shredded or disappeared. And if the president indeed signed in November 1985 a finding that said it was a straight deal of trading arms for hostages, and if he was doing it as early as that, a couple of days after it had happened, then he must have been greatly dissembling a year later when he said he thought that at that time that he thought it was oil drilling equipment, and it puts the whole of the president's position in a very, very questionable light.
And the attorney general's?
And the attorney general, if he was part of that, then he came in, and you notice that it's been stressed that he came in as the friend of the president and not the attorney general, because if he came in as the attorney general...
You mean at the time of the investigation,
In 1986. Last November, that's right. Then that would have been obstructing an investigation, except... Ollie North says this wasn't an investigation. It was just the president's friends coming in to be helpful. And there was even a suggestion that they discussed the possibility of getting rid of the diversion memo as an embarrassment.
Now, we finished the day with getting back to this question that has come up so many times in these hearings of asking for funds for friends of the Nicaraguan rebels, and to what degree the colonel's activity constitutes solicitation.
Well, I thought the closest he came to getting into trouble was when at one point he denied that he had taken part in plans to get big contributors to come into the president's office and was pulled aside by Sullivan and said, I may have done that, which means that he really did admit some of that.
Thank you very much, Dan Schuer. You've been listening to a special report on the Iran-Contra hearings. Tomorrow, the joint congressional investigation will continue with a second day of testimony by Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, the former National Security Council aide who is a key figure in the Iran-Contra affair. This program is produced by Jeff Rosenberg and directed by Andrew Bowers. The editor is John Dingus, assistant producer Donna Fox, research by Martha Ann Overlin and Susan Drian. The studio engineers are Terry Knight and Marty Curcius. For National Public Radio, I'm Cokie Roberts in Washington.
And I assume that we have Newt Gingrich on the line. Okay, so let me do the introduction to the congressman. He's from the Atlanta area. He's chairman of the Investigations and Oversight Committee of the Public Works and Transportation Committee. And although Newt Gingrich is known as a thoroughgoing partisan, he's one of the young Republicans who, with David Stockman and Jack Kemp, set the tone for the new Republican congressman in the 70s and 80s. His message is one of high tech and traditional values in a, quote, conservative opportunity society, as he terms it. He's already had a major impact on national policy, and many believe that he may have more impact in the future. Hi, Congressman. Is that an accurate description?
Well, it's an awfully glowing one, Ruth, and anytime you want to come to a commercial, we want to make sure you have that opportunity.
Okay, well,
I appreciate it.
Thank you. Tell me something. I gather that you have been following the Iran-Contra hearings, and you're familiar with the testimony of Oliver North today. So first of all, let's get your impression.
Well, I think, first of all, that our friends on the left will be very disappointed because it is pretty clear that there was no complex conspiracy in which Ronald Reagan tried to undermine the Constitution. you have here a combat officer, a Marine lieutenant colonel, who very aggressively and zealously tried to do what he thought the president wanted, and who is fairly clear that while he didn't have anybody stopping him, he also wasn't involved in daily meetings with Ronald Reagan getting Reagan's permission. So I think the country is getting an education, and I think in that sense maybe there is some real virtue to these televised hearings.
Let me ask you something, Congressman. One of the things that that was startling today was the fact that Oliver North seemed very adamant that he didn't want to let you know, Congress, that he didn't want to let Congress know about the various things that he was doing, and that he felt that he was righteously engaged in this, and he was right to feel this way because higher authorities had given him permission. But what about his very forthrightness in saying that, in fact, he tried to keep from Congress? He was very reluctant to talk to Congress. He didn't want Congress to know.
Let me surprise you. I don't blame him at all. I think when you see the former head of the Central Intelligence Agency write in his memoirs that he was routinely reading in the paper 24 hours later secret information he was giving the intelligence committees, when you realize that we had two very big blow-ups under Casey in which things were leaked within hours of their being given to the intelligence committees by the Central Intelligence Agency, when you realize that we had a rogue former agent who actually had people killed because he fingered them and said who they were, and in Greece, for example, we had an American agent shot down in cold blood because he'd been named in the papers. Then you put yourself in the shoes of an Oliver North, who is a Marine lieutenant colonel, has been in combat, who goes out around the world and sees human beings who have the courage to risk their lives for America. And you ask yourself, do I really want to tell some congressman knowing that he or his aide may leak it to the Washington Post within 24 hours? And I think over after a while, it does lead to a desperate sense that you may kill your friend overseas if you disclose what you're doing.
Congressman Gingrich, my name is Harvey Stromberg, and I teach at the college here at Santa Monica. Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Isn't it true, though, the Reagan administration got rid of a lot of the constraints that were put on the CIA and other agencies that when Carter was a president? Didn't Reagan do a lot to get rid of a lot of the accounting to congressional committees in both the House and the Senate?
Well, I don't think so. I think that they did a lot to inside the federal executive branch to strengthen the ability to maintain secrets. But in fact, there's been a very aggressive and vigorous oversight by both the House and Senate committees. And as I say, you know, back when you had people like Richard Russell and Scoop Jackson, sometimes as few as three people would be told what was going on. General Marshall, during the Manhattan Project, briefed only three members of the Congress, and all three told him after he began the briefing that they did not want to know any more details, that they trusted him and go spend what was then the phenomenal amount of $2 billion, which is the biggest secret project we've ever had. And it never occurred to any of those people that America would be stronger by putting all of its secrets out on page one. And I think in that sense there's an argument that there are things you want to keep covert. As you know, as a historian, there was a period of almost 40 years where we kept the secret that we had broken the German code in World War II. Now, that meant that there were literally hundreds of people systematically lying about the way in which we won, for example, the Battle of Normandy. And that every major history written from 1945 to about 1980 was essentially flawed.
Right.
But the feeling was that that was a secret so important that it made sense to systematically deceive the entire Western world for a generation because it gave us such a huge advantage in our own national security. And that includes Eisenhower, Marshall, Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman. All these people knew these things. They knew them for a lifetime, and they went to their grave with them.
Well, Congressman, apart from the idea of deception, let's focus for a second on the question of legality. Did Oliver North commit actions that were, in fact, illegal? Didn't, in fact, Congress itself forbid North and others to engage in the kind of actions that they did, in fact, engage in? Isn't it more than a matter of simply lying? Isn't it a matter of breaking the law?
Let me say, first of all, we don't know.
Well, let me ask you this.
What I just said is a very important comment.
Okay.
Ray Donovan went through 3 years of a trial. They spent something like $5 million on legal fees. And at the end of it, a jury in New York City said that the prosecutor's case was so pathetic that they were embarrassed that he had brought it to court. Now, we all of a sudden get Washington Post and New York Times editorials praising Mr. Donovan's innocence. Now you have a case where Congress changed the law 5 times in 6 years. The actual amendment, the Boland Amendment, not only does not have any statutory punishment tied to it, but there are very grave doubts that it's constitutional because it almost certainly impinges on the president's capacity as commander-in-chief. And I suspect that the new court might find it, the Supreme Court might find it simply doesn't hold up in court. And North himself said today unequivocally he never asked anybody for money. I mean, he let them know money was needed, but he skirted the law. He got right up to the edge of it, peered over the edge, and backed off. Now, I don't know if a jury of 12 people is going to find a Marine colonel who has been decorated many times and paid his dues. I don't know that they're going to find him guilty.
What about the obstruction of justice charge with the shredding? Do you think there's any...
Well, wait a second. I got to tell you, in all honesty, if I had the names of people I thought were going to get killed because some idiot was going to leak their names to the press, I'd shred it. I'd shred it in a second.
Even if it was illegal to shred it?
My position would be that if I thought you were going to get my friends killed, and my choice was to shred the document and go to jail, or to hand over their death sentence to you, to the Washington Post, I think, frankly, I'd feel a moral burden to decide to go to jail. That's what civil disobedience is all about. And I suspect if Ollie North goes to jail, knowing that he saved the lives of decent people who were risking their life for America, that I think he'll be able to live with himself a lot better than some of these people who leak every day to the Washington Post.
Congressman, I got to tell you something. We've been talking to various people from Washington, including some of your colleagues, including some that sit on the same side of the aisle as you do. And I got to tell you something. After a full day of doing this, I perceive a real difference between the views of Republican congressmen, perhaps much more so than even the views of Democrats. There appears to be, within the Republican Party, very, very different outlooks and approaches and reactions to the testimony of Oliver North. Has that been your observation as well?
Well, frankly, I haven't talked to anybody yet. I've just been, as a fellow historian,
mm-hmm.
I have been amazed at the sort of shallow and narrow treatment of this whole issue. You know, do we have covert operations? Sure we do. Does that mean we lie about them? Of course we do. I mean, otherwise, how are they covert? Are we a healthy, rational country if we name our allies on page one when they help us in secret, and we did that to Brunei and Saudi Arabia? I think we're crazy. Are we irrational to give the Soviets videotape on television live for day after day about all of our internal processes? I think it is an irrational weakening of America. You know, if you were to take the number of shiploads of Soviet equipment which landed in Cuba and Nicaragua in the last 6 months, and ask yourself, would we be better served as a nation if we had had public hearings on the Soviet threat to American survival, or if we had public hearings on whether or not a handful of people who were too zealous, let's grant that they did more than they should have. Let's grant that the Iranian policy was in fact pretty stupid, because there are no Iranian moderates, and it was crazy to build a policy around the notion that Iranians were going to keep it secret. But having said all that, when these hearings are over, is America going to be stronger? I don't think so. I think we've taught every young person in America that if the President of the United States calls you, you'd better hire a lawyer before you offer to help. And I think we've taught every foreign country that if America needs your help in secret, you'd better not give it unless you're willing to be on page one of the Washington Post and the New York Times.
Okay, there's no two ways about this, that our allies in the Carter years found it difficult to work with our intelligence committees because a lot of information was leaked.
It wasn't difficult. There was a standard rule in the French Intelligence Committee to never... And I met with the retired head of the French Intelligence, and he said their standard rule was never give the Americans anything unless you're willing to have it leaked.
But let me ask you this. What kind of restraints, if any, would you put on our intelligence apparatus?
Well, I'd put a lot of restraints on it. I think there ought to be a very small, and I'm a co-sponsor of Henry Hyde's bill to set up a single committee, a very small, select committee. I think the penalties for leaking off that committee ought to be very, very steep. We have had two different presidents. The second president has had a policy which has been changed five times in 6 years by the Congress. And with that level of amateurism, we're trying to compete with the Soviet Empire. And we now have in Gorbachev a first-class opponent who is relatively young, very professional, and he is going to eat our lunch if we continue to be amateurs. And our response to that is to decide that Oliver North is a greater threat to American survival than a Soviet colony in Cuba and Nicaragua. I find that fairly bizarre.
Congressman, I want to ask you finally a question. You express it quite eloquently. We have seen it during the hearings. Witnesses have come before the committee and testified, and they are not in the least intimidated ashamed of what they have done. They, in fact, are proud of what they have done. They feel that they're American patriots, and they have, in fact, helped save the country, protect the country. And I want to ask you whether you feel that the hearings are a battle for the minds and the hearts of the American people, and whether you think that your viewpoint is winning.
Well, I think, of course, they're a battle for the minds and the hearts of the American people. Look, I don't have any great respect for people who jump up and scream legality, 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 when the whip of the House had to admit on Friday that he had accepted $25,000 in contributions from a savings and loan which he wasn't legally allowed to take, and he therefore had to pay for them now that they were on page one of the various newspapers. I don't have any great impressiveness when people on the left scream legality when the Speaker of the House gave Anwar Sadat a letter at the Camp David peace treaty signings on behalf of a Texan who wanted to get a special deal for the oil concession when the Israelis pulled out of the Sinai. A few weeks after, according to New Republic, the same speaker was allowed to buy into a proven oil well by the guy on whose behalf he was serving as a mailman to the president of Egypt. And I don't have any great impressiveness about people on the left screaming legality when Edward Kennedy has never been challenged over Chappaquiddick in the U.S. Senate and would, in fact, have been allowed to serve as head of the Judiciary Committee, looking over every federal judge in the United States. Now, I think people on the left yell legality because they haven't got the guts to come straight up and say, we are opposed to those who fight communism, and we are in favor of those who are willing to keep their eyes blind while the Soviet Empire builds bases in Central America. And I think from that standpoint, these hearings are essentially political. They're an attempt on the part of those on the left who are opposed to stopping communism and opposed to confronting communism to undermine an administration which was committed to stopping communism. And I think that that's the real underlying issue. And that's why you end up, as I said, with the essentially absurd position on the left that a lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps is a greater threat to American survival than a Soviet empire in Cuba and Nicaragua.
Congressman, I'd like to ask you one last question,
sure,
if I may. You mentioned the fact that congressional laws changed six times in 5 years and that our allies have a hard time working with us because of our intelligence system and the leaks. But don't you think it does damage to our credibility with our allies when an American president says that we will not deal with terrorists and then does sell weapons to Iran or trades them? Don't you think that there's some problem with that?
Of course there is. I think that the dumbest single policy this administration has had was the effort to deal with Iran. And I said it the day that story broke. I was on a trip in Georgia with the Georgia Chamber of Commerce, and I got called in Bainbridge, Georgia, and somebody read me the initial stories and asked my reaction. I said, this has got to be an incredibly dumb policy. So, and, you know, I don't think Ronald Reagan is got 100% batting average. I think the policy with Iran was incredibly dumb. I think that there's no question that the National Security Council did some things that were foolish. I am not in any sense saying, well, let's whitewash it. What I am saying is, if you had to ask yourself which things threaten your grandchildren's freedom and which things threaten your nation's survival, that of all the things we could be holding congressional hearings on this summer, Oliver North and John Poindexter rank fairly far down the list. And America's survival and its ability to live as a free nation will be affected by far more serious things, most of which the left is systematically avoiding talking about.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks for being so forthright with us. We've been fascinated by your comments.